Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Hi, I'm Matthew Workman from Medford, Oregon.
I'm Katie from Muncie, Indiana.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Hart from Brooklyn, New York.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me.
If you'd like to donate to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org
and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart, on the airways.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is film director Ryan Johnson. Before we get to the interview, let's hear a bit of the trailer for his new film, a con man comedy called The Brothers Blue.
How'd you find me?
It's actually pretty simple. We're brothers, and I've come to the conclusion that you don't want out. You think you do, but you don't.
Where are we going?
New Jersey.
Let me grab my coat. This will be the last one.
I'll never ask you to do another con again.
The largest private residence on the eastern seaboard, home of our final mark. Penelope Stamp lived at home her whole life.
So what kind of stuff do you do?
I collect hobbies.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is film director Ryan Johnson. His 2005-2006 feature, Brick, was the culmination of 10 years of post-film school effort and one of the more critically acclaimed and occasionally critically reviled films of that year, noir set in the world of a suburban Los Angeles high school. His newest film is called The Brothers Bloom. It's a sort of fantastical con artist's tale with a heart of gold. Ryan Johnson, welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Thanks for having me on, Jesse.
I had a hard time saying the phrase heart of gold after it occurred to me in my mind.
I could hear the little gap between it formulating in your brain, your lips saying no, and then your brain pushing it through anyway. I could feel your lips saying, you're kidding, right? We're going to, yeah, we said it. We just said it. Here we go.
It seems like you're of that generation, the first generation that grew up with enough consumer video equipment to take up the idea of being a filmmaker as a kid and actually really do something with it. But when did you start making videos?
Really, by really do something with it, you mean waste a lot of time? In my, then absolutely. No, I actually did. I started making movies when I was just a kid, really. I mean, my dad brought home like one of the first video cameras on our block, and this was back before camcorders. This was when it was a video camera, and you had to hook it into the VCR and carry the VCR around with you if you wanted to move, you know, around the house a little bit. So I started with that, and then, you know, in high school, I figured out you could get out of writing papers about Shakespeare if you made a movie about Shakespeare, and so my friends and I, you know, that's what we would do, and that's how we would entertain ourselves, and on weekends, we would all get together and make a movie.
Did you actually make a movie about Shakespeare?
Oh, God, no, we made multiple. Are you kidding?
What plays did you...
We did Midsummer Night's Dream, we did Hamlet, we did Macbeth, when we got to the point where we were doing these super elaborate... First of all, they were filled with in-jokes that only me and my friends would get, and we got to the point where we were doing these super elaborate, like, meta, like, Charlie Kaufman-esque, like, opus. Where basically, at some point, we actually filmed, like, one of us, like, walking down to the, like, quitting the play, quitting, like, the film, walking down to the school and walking into the classroom, and then that person, like, would walk in the classroom live and, like, try and turn off the VCR, and then we, you know, so we got really stupid and elaborate with it, but no, that's how we avoided talking to girls in high school. That's how we did it.
Was that the path to to a good grade in English class, this complicated behind the scenes?
No.
English teachers typically, high school English teachers typically have a more traditional opinion of how narrative should function.
Sort of, yeah, but that, on the other hand, they were kind of just so confused, I think, that we got away with quite a bit. But no, my grades were awful in high school because I was making movies all the time. And actually, that I had a really hard time getting into film school because of that. You know,
I went down to Newport Beach to see a screening of the film at the Newport Beach Film Festival. Newport Beach is this coastal town in Orange County, south of Los Angeles. And I guess I had forgotten that you were from Orange County. What kind of Orange County is such a particular place? Like it's such an odd place. What was your relationship like to being from Orange County when you were a teenager?
Well, I grew up kind of in Colorado. I went to grade school in Colorado, and then we moved to Orange County, to San Clemente, when I was in junior high. And San Clemente is on the very southern tip of Orange County. And San Clemente it's Orange County, but it's very different from Newport Beach. San Clemente is much more of a laid-back, like, little beach town type vibe. And Newport Beach, I think, is more what people traditionally think of when they think of Orange County. But my mom now lives in Laguna Niguel and has for many years, which is very hardcore Orange County. And I actually, I mean, I think that there tends to be kind of a real snobbery that exists in Los Angeles about Orange County, and a real prejudice, kind of the way that, you know, people who don't live in the South feel about the South to a certain extent, you know, even if they've never really been there. And I'm actually really grateful that I grew up there and that my mom lives there now, and I go down and I, you know, I see her friends, and I can see that, you know, like most other things in life, you know, on the surface, all the cliches exist down there, but there's also people living, you know, really rich, beautiful lives, and there's wonderful stuff going on down there, and there's a lot more than what's on the surface, I guess. So I like Orange County a lot, actually, you know, so.
Your movies have one of these hallmarks of movies of people who grew up in the home video era, which is they feel incredibly informed about past film, like astonishingly informed. And I wonder if you were a film nerd in addition to being a making films nerd by the time you were a teenager, or whether that was like a film school thing.
No, yeah, I was being, because my family are all film buffs. They're not in the film industry. My dad and my uncles, my grandfather, they're all in the home building industry, but they all loved movies. And so, you know, my grandfather, you know, introduced me to Fellini movies and showed me La Strada and, you know, Amarcord. And my dad was a big Scorsese fan, so he was, you know, showing me Raging Bull very early on. And but it really was film school, though, where I completely kind of super saturated my brain with all these things. It's strange, though, because I think maybe there's sometimes the misperception that this is, you know, that when you see echoes of lots of movies in a movie, that it was created like that consciously, or that it was stitched together as some sort of artificial patchwork. It seems inconceivable, the idea of consciously saying, oh, okay, I'll take this from this and this from this and this from that. You know, the act of creating this stuff is a very organic and very unconscious type thing, you know. And then I think it may just be a matter of you are what you eat to a certain extent, you know. But I don't know if it's a generational thing, because I was going to say, when in film school, I carried around that book, Scorsese on Scorsese, you know, and just read that constantly. And all he talks about in that are the other movies that it's informed him, as well as his experiences in life. So I don't know. I don't know.
Let's talk a little bit about Brick, because Brick is, for one thing, I thought it was a really remarkable film, but one of the things that's most interesting about it is that it is so squarely in the noir genre. It is so specifically a genre film, but it is also so completely odd and personal.
Yeah.
Why did you create that film and, you know, drag it around for the 5 years that it took for somebody to give you money to make it?
Well, I mean, it kind of started with discovering Dashiell Hammett's novels, and on kind of a very formal level, that was kind of the thing that got me going, was the world he created in those books. But what really got it going, and from the personal angle of it for me, was for some reason, again, the world of those books and the world of detective fiction connected really solidly with the kind of, I think to a certain extent, we all tend to turn our high school, our adolescent memories into mythology in our minds and tend to blow them up to something slightly bigger than life in the back of our heads. And for me, for whatever reason, the elemental things that are make up detective fiction clicked like two Legos coming together with the memories I had of that time. And this feeling that this kind of hostile world and this feeling that you're a detective kind of trying to figure out this weird mystery and this very stratified social dynamic and the appeal of somebody who could, you know, smash through that in order to get what he wanted, you know. So that it resonated on a very deep level, and I ended up being able to just plug a lot of these weird emotional memories of high school and adolescence into this very weird detective story, I guess.
Pin. The Pin?
The Pin, yeah.
Pin's kind of a local spook store. You know the Kingpin.
I've heard it.
Same thing. Supposed to be old, like 26, lives in town.
Dope runner, right?
Big time.
See, the Pin pipes it from the lowest scrapper to Brad Bramish himself.
Maybe. I mean, ask any dope rat where the junk sprang, and they'll say they scraped it off that, who scored it off this, who bought off so, and after four or five connections, the list always ends with the Pin. But I bet you got every rat in town together and said, show your hands, if any of them actually seen the Pin, you get a crowd of full pockets.
I think the Pin's just a tail to take whatever heat.
But what's first?
Show of hands.
It's almost more stylized than the genre ordinarily is. Like, the stylization is at the same time played very straight and almost absurd.
Yeah.
Why did you make that choice?
I guess the most utilitarian reason was that it was really important to me to establish from the very beginning of the whole thing that we were not in a teenage world, you know, a real teenage world, that this wasn't about, on one level, that this wasn't about real teenage violence, but on the other level, that we were operating in a very heightened reality for a very specific purpose, you know. And so to that end, that's where the language element of it, which obviously teenagers don't talk like that, but that's, you know, hopefully the first time you hear something come out of someone's lips, you have to kind of reevaluate where we are here, especially because the surroundings were very real, you know, were just you know, locker cages in a high school, you know, and we have a certain set of expectations about what a movie like that is once we see those visual cues. So
at the same time, though, teenagers do. I mean, they don't talk like the teenagers in your movie, but I think that idea of teenagers creating their own world was
absolutely, and it that was another thing that clicked together between the world of high school and the world of this detective fiction. They both create this weird slang, and they both do it for exactly the same reason, which is so the grown-ups won't know what they're talking about or what they're doing. I mean, that's the criminal patter was precisely that, so the cops won't, you know, be able to follow. And you know, and that's where it happens with the teen. So it was just another one of those things that just slid together nicely.
We had orange juice, Brendan. I'm sorry. How about some Tang? No, that's more like soda, isn't it?
Water's fine, ma'am. Thanks.
Oh, wait a minute. We have apple juice here if you'd like that. Or we've got milk, but you're having that on your cornflakes.
Apple juice sounds terrific.
It's country style.
That's perfect.
And I'll even give it to you in a little country glass. How about that? Okay. Well, I'm going to go do something in the other room.
So, how about we take another snap at hearing your tale?
I don't know. It starts out same as before. This floor ain't carpeted.
You're cool, dog.
Your muscles seem plenty cool putting his fist in my head. Want him out.
I thought Brick was really funny. And I was impressed by the way that the funniness, never to me at least, undercut the reality, or, you know, hyper reality or whatever it was, or undercut the emotions, so that while you're going through this really huge emotionally scaled thing, you know, that sort of mirrors both the noir and the adolescence in general.
Right.
Like, you could have, the jokes in the film could have been the kind that, you know, contrast with that and undercut it.
Right.
Was that a choice that you made consciously not to ever spoof or mock?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think that was so elemental, it didn't even feel like a choice to me. I mean, it was, you know, it was, I think, probably just a byproduct of, you know, first and foremost, my priority with, you know, both Brick and Bloom and hopefully anything I create is to be honest, you know. In a weird way, the more weird and bizarre you're being and the farther you're pushing the material, the more honest you have to be, I think. That ends up being, and so the humor that arises, you know, from it, hopefully comes organically from the situations, you know. And I agree. I tend to laugh at Brick a lot more than most people who watch it. I think, you know, I think it's really funny. But I also think that, you know, there's a lot of movies that seem very serious that, like Barton Fink, for example, I think is hilarious, you know, or I think that. Then that's my favorite kind of humor, the humor that isn't, you know, it's not like it's jokes that are peppered in there. It's comes directly from the situations, you know.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. In just a minute, more with director Ryan Johnson. His new movie, The Brothers Bloom, opens this week in New York and Los Angeles and over the next couple of weeks across the country.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
Hey guys, Jesse here. The 2009 Maximum Fun Drive is drawing to a close. I think as I record this, there's about 36 hours left. And so I decided I wanted to take this break to thank the more than 500 people who donated to support MaximumFun.org and pledged to donate once a month into the future. Besides them, of course, I also want to thank all the folks who've been donating over the years to support this endeavor. I'm really proud to make something that people care enough about to give me support that they don't have to give me. Hopefully your pledge dollars will show up as cool new guests and new opportunities for the show. We have some really specific plans that you'll see unfold over the next few months. And I really appreciate all your support. Of course, if you haven't donated already, The Sound of Young America isn't just supported by your donations during the Maximum Fun Drive. So you can always visit MaximumFun.org/donate and pledge to give $2, $5, $10, $20, a month, however much you can spare to support this show. So anyway, thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate it. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. Let's get back to my interview with Brothers Bloom director Ryan Johnson. Your new movie, The Brothers Bloom, is a con man movie about two brothers who grow up together, mm-hmm. essentially running cons, with one as the front, played by Adrian Brody, and one played by Mark Ruffalo as sort of the brains or the schemer.
Right.
Why did you want to do a con man movie?
Well, it's weird. The con man genre is something that seems like, you know, if you're a film lover, you tend to have a special place for, a special affection for. And I always did. And so, I mean, the fundamental start of this thing, like years and years ago, was just the notion of doing a con man movie. But what really hooked me into it, and you know, the personal element of it that actually got me going on it was the idea of, instead of doing a procedural thing about the act of conning and instead of making it about the plot, the idea of, first of all, doing a character-based con man movie, which is tricky because it's a genre where the audience is trained to distance themselves from the characters.
In fact, even in watching your film, even early on, I felt that distance because I hate getting tricked.
Exactly. Well, that's where you're at the beginning as the audience. It's all about, and that's the pleasure typically of con man movies, is who's going to screw who over at the end of it. So, I mean, my notion was, okay, well, if we explicitly make that the main character's dilemma, and that's Bloom's dilemma at the beginning of it, Adrian Brody's character, is that everything feels fake to him, you know, and everything does feel just like this constructed nonsense. And at the beginning of it, you know, it's in this incredibly stylized world where there's, you know, it feels so wacky, and you're kind of, you know, everything feels like it's being written by this maniacal Steven character. And like Bloom, you should kind of feel like you want to break out of that and find something quote unquote real, you know. And I mean, I was going to say this, that kind of the second part of what really connected with me and kind of got me going on that was using the con man story as kind of a more fable type thing in order to explore the connection between storytelling and real life and where those two meet. Not for storytellers, not for directors or writers or anything like that, but just for us as human beings living our lives. The degree to which being able to take in all this raw information from the world outside and basically tell it back to yourself. And that's kind of how you form the narrative of how you think about the world. And so to a certain extent, being a good storyteller and stepping up to the plate and, you know, telling your story well is a very essential part, I think, of you know, living a good life.
So, the tale. You tell them there's a hermit in the woods. A one-eyed, steel-toothed vagabond.
With blood-red eyes?
That's good. He stopped you coming home from school.
And told me of a cave.
What kind of cave?
A cave of wonder.
Ha.
Shut up, Dave. At noon on every Sunday, there appears a ball of light, which flutters like a butterfly.
A will-o-wisp?
That's right. It guides you.
If you can keep up.
To where the treasure's lay.
So where's this cave?
Yeah, where?
Aha!
The hermit didn't say.
He got this greedy, glinting look, the filthy red-eyed leech, and said he'd tell for 30 bucks.
Well, that's just $2 each!
And so that Sunday, straight from church, into the woods, Bloom led.
You have this really great cast in this movie. I ended up having an argument on the way home about whether Adrian Brody was cooler than Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
I said yes.
Wow, oh my God.
Yeah, I know, right? Pretty good, right?
You gotta get Adrian on the show. I think he'll enjoy that.
Controversial choice.
Controversial choice, yeah. Now, hey, look, I'll go with that.
Tell me a little bit about how you drew this cast to the film.
Yeah.
When you had made this one tiny movie that was really weird.
Well, I'm kind of baffled by it myself, and I say that completely honestly. That's not like self-deprecating. I really actually am not sure, you know, why we are able to attract the talent. I think that they, you know, it comes down to the script. For whatever reason, that the script lined up with what they each were interested in doing. You know, I know Rachel was looking to do a comedy because she was coming off of Constant Gardner and The Fountain and some really heavy stuff, and you know, she wanted to show what she could do in terms of being a lighter character. And I think the fact that that character Penelope also had quite a bit going on with it was really appealing to her, you know. You know, Mark was Mark Ruffalo. I mean, the character Mark plays is kind of this big Fellini-type showman, you know. And that's very different, I think, than what Mark is typically known as playing. You know, he usually plays these dark, intense characters on the screen.
Brooding type
guys. Yeah, exactly, like Brando type, you know. But the funny thing is, it's the reason I cast him in that part is because when I sat down and met with him, he's, you know, he's much more like his part in this movie than he is like, he's not a dark, intense guy. He's kind of like a real, he's an Italian family man, you know. He's kind of hugging everybody, and you know, he's kind of got that energy. So
his energy in the film reminded me a little bit of like George Clooney, that kind of
right.
Like that kind of like lopsided grin sort of thing.
He's got that, but he's also, I mean, Clooney can step in and be like the master of the universe, you know what I mean, and just be this impenetrable cool. And what was really interesting for me is that Mark has a vulnerability that he can't eradicate, you know, that he can't completely put up the front, and he has a little bit of off-centeredness. He's never going to be, you know, he's never going to be that guy, you know. And and to put him in the role of that guy then was what was really interesting to me, because I hoped that kind of, you know, that soft underbelly would give the character a little more dimension and keep you aware through the whole movie that, you know, at the base of all this is this, you know, emotional core that he loves his brother and he's genuinely trying to give his brother what he wants, you know.
There's a fourth primary character in this film, sort of demolitions expert sidekick to the brothers named Bang Bang, who doesn't speak almost at all through the course of the film and is kind of goofy. Tell me about why this character was part of the film.
Well, I was really interested in trying to do a nonverbal character that was as strong a character as anybody else in the movie. Because I'm a big Marx Brothers fan, and Harpo was always my favorite character. And I always felt just Harpo was like the strongest character in all the, I mean, I love, you know, Groucho and but Harpo always shone for me. And so that notion was really appealing. Also, my friend who acted in Brick, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's very into clowning, and he kind of has become over the past few years very close with this Russian troupe of clowns, led by.
I think that's happened to all of us.
At some point, we all go through that phase. It's kind of like, oh, he's gone to the Russian troupe of clowns phase. Yeah.
Ultimate Frisbee's next.
Be playing hacky sack in Berkeley, and then he'll become normal again. It's okay. Just wait it out. Russia, the clowning is taken really seriously as an art. You know, it's very different than the pie in the face type thing here. It's kind of existential clowning over there. So he had kind of turned me on to these shows, and these are nonverbal shows, you know, where it's an entire show where they communicate these incredibly complicated, you know, emotions through just body language. So anyway, that was kind of the start of the whole thing. And then I've kind of had this notion that I'm a fan of Asian cinema, and I have, you know, all these Asian actors that I love in the movies, and I figured, okay, as long as I have a role that doesn't require dialogue, which is probably going to be a pretty rare occurrence for me in my career because I love dialogue so much, I made the character an Asian woman so that I could, you know, so I could work with an actor I never would have gone to work with before. And then I was lucky enough through the casting process to find Rinko Kikuchi, who most people know from Babel, but she started in Japan doing comedies. So she actually had this incredible comic timing. And she was just as excited about doing this nonverbal performance as I was and seeing if we could make it work. So it kind of became this challenge that the two of us, kind of jumped on, I guess, you know.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Ryan Johnson, is the writer-director of the new film, The Brothers Bloom. His first film was the critically acclaimed high school noir, Brick. Something that somebody brought up at the screening that I'm so happy they brought up because I never would have noticed was the fact that you gave Tom Cruise a thank you mention in the credits. Now, look, if you had a thank you mention to Matt Damon or Ben Affleck or some other, there are certain huge stars that I could certainly see having like thrown you a dinner where you met the producer that financed the film or something like that. I would not necessarily pick Tom Cruise as being that person. So tell me why Tom Cruise got a thank you.
I met with Tom Cruise because, I guess he had very early in the process, before we had done any casting, he had read the script and he liked the script and we did a meeting. And it was never like a serious thing. It was never actually going to happen that he was going to like play a role in it or something. I think it was just, you know, we sat down and met, and we ended up spending like almost 4 hours sitting together talking through the script, and it ended up being one of the most like intense story sessions that I had, like, even, you know, with the exception of a couple screenwriter friends of mine. He really knew the thing backwards and forwards, and he has actually an incredible sense of story. And so it ended up being this phenomenally useful discussion that lasted the entire afternoon, that again, it wasn't really, I didn't think that he was actually ever going to be a part of it, really. But I ended up, just based on our discussion, making some major changes to the script. And
what do you learn from a Tom Cruise?
Oh, so much.
What kind of knowledge did he drop on you?
It was specific story stuff. It was stuff that wouldn't make much sense now, because it was about a previous draft of the script, and it was about some stuff that, you know, it was entirely dissecting the story and figuring out elements of it that were and weren't working, you know. But I was, you know, this was right at the height of all the supposed craziness about Tom Cruise on the internet and what have you. You know, this was at the height of all of that. And I don't know, man. I mean, unless they gassed me when I walked in, and I don't, you know, and unless they gave me Kool-Aid or something, he was just a cool guy.
You just replaced him with Peter Bogdanovich dressed as Tom Cruise.
I would have spotted the cravat. I would have spotted the neckerchief. I would have known right away. No, he was just a normal, cool guy. And like I said, really generous with his time, and really, especially for what's relative to the stuff he does, this was a tiny project, you know. And so I was really grateful for it.
At what point in the 3 hours of hanging out with Tom Cruise were you able to relate to him as though he was an actual person?
You know, it's weird. I don't know. I mean, you know, meeting someone for 3 hours in that context, especially when it's Tom Cruise, there's a certain part of your brain that's always every, you know, 20 seconds, this is Tom Cruise, you know, just in the back of your head. But at the same time, he was immediately, like,
just
personable.
Superimposes the flight suit over his body.
Yeah,
in front
exactly.
Of you.
No, it was the opposite of that from the very start. Anything that was that, I brought to the table in the back of my own head. And I think we all would, just because we grew up watching him in movies. But he himself was just totally personable and cool, and it was, you know, I don't know. He was cool to me, you know.
It sounds like your next movie is another pseudo genre piece that's a big departure from your previous two.
Yeah, it's very different. Yeah. It's a kind of a science fiction type thing. It's called Looper, and it's kind of dark, kind of violent. It's the exact opposite of Bloom. It's very different from Brick, and, you know, just take a crack at something different, I guess. You know?
Is this movie your ticket to direct The Dark Knight 4?
This is my shot at the big time, Thorne. I'm not going to blow this one. This is my ticket off this little island.
Next time, Cruise is going to be giving you a lot more than just story tips.
Exactly. Yeah, no. If anything, I'm you know, this is kind of a...
If anything, you're marginalizing yourself
further.
That's
my goal, is to at some point just be... I'm trying to work my way backwards to where I'm using my dad's video camera again at some point, which will probably happen. No, it's, you know, everybody... sci-fi does have a, you know, a real appeal. I mean, for me, I'm a huge sci-fi fan, so I'm really excited to be able to take a crack at it. Again, though, it, you know... I mean, the basis of the thing is... I guess it's easy to just say sci-fi and automatically, you know, people get excited about it. But what really has gotten me going on it is, you know, the characters and what the story is actually about, which is something I'm really excited about, and which, you know, we could have a 3-hour talk about after after this if you want.
I want to ask one follow-up to the Tom Cruise question.
You're celebrity obsessed, man.
Are you the kind of guy who had... This is a really weird celebrity for me to be obsessed with, but it's true. Are you the kind of guy who has a similar relationship to the idea of Ricky Jay that other people have to the idea of Tom Cruise?
Yes, that's a really good analogy, actually. It's a very good analogy. I was a huge, huge Ricky Jay fan. Going back to... I guess it was like around 99 or 2000. Back when we were trying to get Brick made, I was working at the Disney Channel, and somebody slipped me a VHS of his show 52 Assistants, which had been on HBO. And I wore that tape then, like, watching it over and over again. And I just kind of fell in love with what he is, you know, what he does, and how he presents this incredible body of knowledge that he has. And, you know, both as a performer and as a scholar of all these things that, you know, and a lot of the things in Bloom that end up on the screen in Bloom are, you know, obsessions of mine that I feel like I wouldn't have come to if it weren't for Ricky Jay, you know. So and then there was this weird thing where a very good friend of mine from college was his assistant for many years, and so there was this bizarre thing, because I will actually you know, I'm the type where if I'm sitting next to a celebrity or something, I'll probably actually be rude, like just in a public space, I'll probably be rude to them because I'm trying not to notice, you know, not to like impose on them or notice them or something. So there was this weird thing whenever my friend and I hung out where I never mentioned Ricky and he never mentioned Ricky, but he knew I was a big fan and I knew he was his assistant. It was kind of... But eventually we, you know, eventually I did get to
You might be concerned that you would say something wrong and he would kill you with a playing card.
Precisely, just right
as outlined in his book, Cards as Weapons.
Exactly, precisely. Yeah, they just straight into the head of a deer, you know, just thunk. He throws it harder and faster than any man on the planet, and I've seen him do it. It's pretty incredible.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on The Sound of Young America.
Thanks for having me, man. It's a real pleasure.
Ryan Johnson's new movie is The Brothers Bloom. It opens May 15th in New York and Los Angeles, May 22nd in select cities. And if your city wasn't selected, it opens nationwide on May 29th. Thanks again, Ryan.
Thanks.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. Please excuse my dog barking in the background. Someone's walking on the roof. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Our editor is Nick White. You can find us online at the all-new MaximumFun.org. And you can always email me at jesse@MaximumFun.org. My thanks again to everyone who's donated in the Maximum Fun Drive. And if you haven't and you're downloading this right away, you've still got about 36 hours to do it. We'll be sending out tons of thank you gifts and t-shirts and mustache TVs and all that good stuff within a few weeks. So expect to get it in about a month, maybe 6 weeks. We'll see you next time right here on The Sound of Young America.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. 6 big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.